education committee will come to order. And we have a order of business that I want to bring up on Senate File 1800. And that's Senator Phoebe's bill that was laid on the table. And what I would like to do is to make a motion or have someone make a motion, Senator Perez Ray. The motion would be to pass Senate File 1800 and send it to the Judiciary Committee. The first motion would be to move to reconsider Senate. Well, we didn't pass it. I guess the motion would be to take Senate File 1800 off the table.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Therese Ray moves to put Senate File 1800 before the committee. And then the motion would be to pass Senate File 1800 and refer it to the Judiciary Committee.
So moved, Mr. Chairman. Good.
Senator Therese Ray moves that Senate File 1800 be, again, members, for the purpose, there was a section in 1800 that this was the bill relating to mandates in special education. And the Judiciary Committee wants to look over, there's a section in there that they want to, relating to, I believe, what was it?
The burden of proof.
And so that's the reason for what we're doing. And so on Senator Therese Ray's motion to pass Senate File 1800 as amended, I believe, and send it to the Judiciary Committee. On that motion, is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor?
Can I ask?
What this will do will be is it'll go to another committee, the Judiciary Committee.
It'll be discussed there.
Yes.
Okay.
On Senator Therese Ray's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Okay, now we go back to Senate File 867, Senator Saltzman. And members, we are working off of the A9 amendment. Senator Saltzman moves to take Senate File 867 from the table. Senator
Thank
Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
So I think, Mr. Chair, we were in the middle, we had some amendments, and last time, I'm trying to remember where I am between all the bills we're presenting today, so.
It's hard to remember exactly where you were.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of questions, if I may.
Yes, and I apologize to Senator Therese Ray. On my little pad of paper, I had your name down for a question, and somehow I missed it, so Senator Therese Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We ran out of time anyway, and I have to apologize in advance because I am going to be called to present a bill in just a minute, so I hope I don't get interrupted, mm-hmm. Senator Saltzman. But I had a question about Section 14, that's page 16, with respect to the reports. I read the language in Section 14 and read that the report from the schools should include information about school nutrition, attrition, governance, management, staffing, finances, economic performance, operational performance, innovative practices, implementation, future plans, and that these reports need to be, we need public, they need to make these publications, mail, make it available to electronic means to the commissioner, to the sponsors, to the school employees, and parents or legal guardians of the students. I'm just wondering, Senator, do we do this with other schools? And I mean, this is extensive reporting, and I was wondering how we came up with language that was that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Salzman.
And Senator Torres-Ray, well, I think we need to think about a charter school and sometimes as a mini school district, because they are not just a school. They are sort of an entity. They are a nonprofit organization. And our school districts do a lot of reporting. If you notice that they have to do some annual reports, and I think I could maybe ask council if they're aware of some of the reports that our public schools need to do, and we're certainly working on that. And as you'll notice, we've given some options as to online 16.13. We give them a lot of options, that the annual report is by publication, mail, or electronic means to the commissioner. That's how they can distribute it. In terms of some of the information that is being, you know, suggested here, is that before it was published an annual report. And I think this is where we reflect on some of the transparency and accountability issues, that it's very clear to the public and to the charter school community and to the sponsor what has happened what has happened over the past year. Charter schools go through a relicensure, sort of a rechartering process after 3 and 5 years. So this is sort of an annual report, which many organizations do. And Mr. Piccolo appears to be wanting to come to the table, and I would love to have him. Because a lot of this is all about being able to document accountability. And I know that we're trying not to burden any of our district schools right now. We have a mandate bill up after this. But I think if we look at it as a way to show improvement, because remember, we are giving additional freedoms, reducing mandates on charter schools in exchange for higher results. And what do we learn from charter schools? That's the other thing, is we've talked about the lack of transferring of information. So, Mr. Piccolo.
Senator Salzman, I believe the charter schools have to comply with the UFARS reporting system. That's the reporting system that all public schools use. So, Mr. Piccolo.
Senator Stump, Senator Torres-Ray, charter schools do meet UFARS, STARS, MARS, the student recording system, so all of those state accounting systems are something that charter schools are required by law to comply with. The annual report has been something that's been in law since the beginning. What we are doing here is basically putting in statute some of the basic elements. Any nonprofit does an annual report to its constituencies and its funders and so forth, and this just picks up on that and puts into law some of the basic elements that should be in an annual report and that are already required by the commissioner. The one area that is new in here in particular is the innovation, reporting on innovation, because one of the things we have heard from the legislature is that there has not been a process for collecting information about innovation. So we're saying let's put it in the annual report. Those are public documents. We can collect all that and then start to say here's what is going on in terms of innovation. So this is not something burdensome, because all this information exists by the schools. It's putting it in a format as an annual report.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's great. I wish we would have a response like this from other schools when we ask them to report to us about academic performance and innovation. And, Mr. Chairman, my other question relates to page 20. That's line 2012, which is related to the reporting requirements, and I wonder if we have anything similar for the entire school system that says that sustained failure to meet pupil performance requirements contained in the contract. I think that we should have this.
Senator Torres-Rae, can you tell us which line? You're on page 20?
I am on page 20. So this is section 19, which refers to...
Line 12, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me.
On page 20.
Yes, page 20, line 12. Excuse me.
Here. Now that point, Mr. Chair.
Senator Salzman.
I think we want to go back to the fact that charter schools, in exchange for being freed from rules, regulations, and statutes that apply to every other public school, we are exempting them from many things. In exchange for that, there's some type of accountability for better results. And so one of the conditions of the relief from some of these rules is that it is appropriate to really kind of raise the bar and look at academic performance. And so this is sustained failure. And so, in other words, if we're giving freedom to these schools and they're not showing improved performance, why are we exempting them from all of these rules and regulations? So that's been one of the things, is that with charter schools, and what, you know, we've heard, or I think I've heard from charter school advocates, is that we want to hold them more accountable because of we've relaxed some rules for them. They have great potential to not become compliant. We heard a couple days ago when we were listening to our reading bill from Mr. Savage from Eden Prairie, and some of the most excellent testimony I've heard in this committee, although everybody in this room has always provided great testimony, but really talking about we need to expect more from children. And this is, I think, to be able to, that a charter school and its sponsor has a contract, and part of that contract is about academic performance. What we've seen, I probably seen too often, is when charter schools have been closed, is that it's because of some sort of regulation or they've concerns about management. We really haven't focused enough on their performance. Maybe Mr. Piccolo wants to address this as well.
Senator Torres-Rae, this section D is about the power of the commissioner to be able to cancel a contract if a school is not performing on overall a long run. Currently, sponsors can do that, but the commissioner could not. So this just puts into law the similar kind of powers for the commissioner in terms of a school not performing academically over a period of time.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To this point, is what is a sustain, over what period of time do charter schools have to demonstrate raising student performance? Is it, do they get 5 years? Do they get 10 years? What is the?
At the time, Mr. Chair.
Senator Salzman.
And a good question, Senator Rummel. Some of the pieces in here where the commissioner has the authority to essentially step in is the result that in the past there's had to be a process and it's taken a long time to actually take any kind of action. And so charter schools right now, after they start, they will reapply for their charter in 3 years, and then they have a 5 year period. So there's sort of like a first a three and then a five. But then along the way, there are opportunities that if something is going on and a sponsor is not responding, that then the commissioner. And there's some flexibility here. I would like to have some flexibility in the bill than being very black and white. So that I think that there's sometimes extenuating circumstances, and if we make things too firm, I think then there's always that, but this was going on or that was going on. So I think the idea is that here the commissioner has the opportunity to really step in and intervene if needed.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Salzman, I tend to agree with you on that. You know, I think too often we make decisions by bright line things, and we don't have any qualifiers. So I do support that. I was just curious, mm-hmm. just because of where it occurs in the bill, if this is something that's in the contract. But I agree with the position you've taken.
Okay. Senator Salzman?
Well, unless there's any other questions or people want to testify, there are people here who probably have different opinions on this bill that would speak in favor of some of the things, but I know that we do want to get through this bill because I believe it needs to go to state and local government for the advisory committee. There may be people who want to speak to specific issues. I would welcome that, and if needed, perhaps other people can help me reply.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
I'd like to ask a couple of questions, and I apologize. I got here a little bit late here. Maybe you already addressed this, but I was looking at Section 24. Have you talked about that?
Senator Salzman.
Senator Hand. Okay. Yes, Section 24. Thank you very much. I wonder if Mr. Schroeder is here. I know he's maybe presenting another bill, so I will do my best. The single-purpose sponsor is in another bill that I had introduced. It was actually part of the governor's proposal for charter schools a couple years ago. And the idea behind a single-purpose sponsor is that it would be a charitable organization, a 501c3, that would be formed exclusively just to sponsor charter schools. And right now, a nonprofit can apply, but it's an existing nonprofit that probably has, you know, a mission that may be consistent with charter schools, but may have other there are other programs that it is involved in. To give you sort of an idea of what this might look like, Education Evolving is very interested in doing this, not as its own, but have put together already a suggested board for this particular sponsor that would include former superintendents, business leaders, education experts, to put together that their sole purpose would be to sponsor charter schools. And Education Evolving, and there are other people out there that would have, like, you know, those sorts of interests, is really on how do we really create new schools. And the book, I think it's over there, Disrupting Class, and here's Mr. Schroeder, just on cue, to speak to this. But that really is something that is a different model. And if you look at some states, I believe Nevada right now, some states are developing sort of a single-purpose sponsor, and they will sponsor all the charter schools in the state. I believe in that, and that's not to suggest we move to that model here, but again, we need really good sponsors. And that's what this bill, a lot of it is all about, is really spelling out the criteria for who a sponsor should be, what sort of threshold do they need to meet. And I've talked to the commissioner about this, and so it's not like five, it's one or two, and that there would be an application process. They would have to meet, as all the others. The only difference would be is that they, because they haven't existed for 4 years, they would have to show some sort of five-year financial plan. And the thought is that some of these groups, if there's interest, would probably apply to foundations to get started. Mr. Schroeder, would you like to add anything to that? And Mr. Schroeder, as we heard from earlier in our charter school working group, has been very involved in charter schools since the beginning of charter school time. So I really appreciate the chance to work with, as I call them, the godfathers of charter schools.
Thank you.
Please give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is John Schroeder. I do work with Education Evolving. One other point to add to what Senator Salzman said about the rationale now, and particularly the timeliness of this particular provision, which has been around, it's been in bills proposed by the department previously, something we've been very interested in, to get a level of expertise and focus and specialization in this area of oversight of charter schools, since virtually all of our sponsors do something else as their main line of business. We'd really like to get an organization or two that focuses just on this activity. One additional reason now for this, it's very important, is the The overall effort within this legislation to improve the quality of sponsoring and the fact that we're going to have an approval process for sponsors by the commissioner. Right now we have around 60, I think, sponsors in Minnesota, and we know that some of them are not going to apply and some of them are not going to be approved. We also have 10 schools that the department is currently sponsoring that were originally approved on appeal back when we had an appeal, and the State Department is actually, or the commissioner is actually the official sponsor, and the department wants to get out of that business and focus itself now on overseeing sponsors, not overseeing schools. And so we know we're going to have a supply issue here of schools that are orphans, that don't have sponsors. And so creating some new sponsors that focus just on that and having really the commissioner be able to have the discretion to do that as needed is another rationale that adds to the urgency of including this provision.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Schroeder.
Senator. Perhaps what I'm thinking, Mr. Chair, is that as long as Mr. Schrader's here, before someone asks the question, just briefly, I do want to point out, as Dr. McQuay did, on lines 219 through 225, some new language that we would also, as we've had the Charter School Advisory Council in the past, two things I did want to add was, one of the things I would like to see this group do is identify models to improve communication, cooperation, and exchange of ideas between and among public charter and district schools. I think we've had that discussion about how we do, you know, really transfer good ideas and also build better relationships. I think some of the states where, you know, their districts are more involved now have seen the opportunity for charter schools. They have better relationships. And then also that they would also recommend to the commissioner and legislature an organizational model to give state-level leadership to new school planning, development, startup, and successful ongoing operation in both district and charter sectors of our public education. And that's, again, to look at how do we support innovation and best practices and new models within both our charter and district schools, and, you know, to sort of take a look at where is the leadership for that at, that charter schools should not have and don't have the only monopoly on being innovative, that our district schools have that potential, and we've heard about some exciting models that are going on, and how do we even replicate those. So.
All right. Members? Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, I had one other question. I know this morning when we were talking about the building corporation and the lease aid, and I had asked if there was anybody that could talk about the provisions in the Section 17 in particular from the perspective of the building corporations, if there was anybody. I don't know if there was anybody that was here and prepared to talk about this, but I wanted to get some, I guess, testimony on the changes that we've contemplated and how they are viewed. And so I just wanted to see if there was anybody that wanted to talk about that.
Please give your name for the record.
My name is John Gutierrez. I'm the executive director of St. Croix Preparatory Academy. And I'd like to thank the senators, and thank you, Senator Saltzman. She's invited me to present some similar information on the subcommittee, and we won't take 30 minutes to do it, but perhaps just two or three. Regarding the building corporation in Section 17, I should say Section 17, I might note that St. Croix Preparatory Academy does have a building company, and we've recently issued bonds of approximately $22 million and are constructing the school facility. I guess I'd say the concern that may be here in this section is if it adequately addresses the facility needs of a school. And let me just walk through the timing. In Subdivision 17, Section the B, there's a three-year waiting period before a school can set up a building corporation. Upon that time, then it has to go through the approval process, an affidavit with the Department of Education, and so on. With the formation of a building company, there are some timing issues with that. The simple paperwork of articles incorporation and bylaws and board of directors is a fairly simple process, but there's generally a 12 to 18 month waiting time from the IRS for a tax determination letter. So before a building company could actually enter into a transaction, it's probably going to be the 3-year waiting time plus 18 months. So it's probably nearer a 5-year waiting period. I'm not sure if that's if that matters, but I just wanted to explain that. At this point, if the building company cannot renovate or if it can't purchase a piece of property, then it has to wait a couple more years before it can go through the construction process, which is in the next paragraph of this particular section. To back up, from a building company perspective and from a corporation perspective, there's no difference between the purchase of an existing piece of property, the renovation of an existing piece of property, or the construction of a brand new facility. Because in either case, the logistical items that need to take place are the same. So if you were to purchase an existing piece of property, you'd have to go through site approval, potentially rezoning. You have to engage in an architect, in a contractor, and then you'd have to go through the financing. And the financing is usually done through an investment bank and a lease revenue bond. So that would be the process for renovation of an existing piece of property or purchasing of an existing piece of property. It's no different than if you were constructing a new piece of property. So from my perspective, it seems that the construction could be included with the renovation or the purchasing of an existing piece of property. So those would be my only comments on this. From somebody that's gone through this process at St. Croix Preparatory Academy, what happens is facilities is often the most challenging issue of a school, finding a facility that works. And so long waiting periods can be very detrimental to the programming, to the enrollment, and to the stability of a charter school.
This is a new charter or new facility that you're talking about?
Correct.
And you were able to sell bonds against the lease aid?
The building company is able to issue bonds, correct.
And the bond holders know that it's, I mean, how explain a little bit about how the security of that bond that for somebody that's holding that bond.
The bondholders have interest in the facility. So, for instance, when they issue the bonds, the debt holders are financial institutions, so they've invested in the facility. The construction of the facility takes place, and then bond payments are made by the building company to the bondholders.
I just want to read you something here. Subdivision 7 of Chapter 124D. Money received from the state may not be used to purchase land or buildings. The school may own land and buildings if obtained through a non-state source.
Right. And the building and the land is owned by the building company. So Mr. Chair, we walked through the transaction in a subcommittee. It took about 30 to 45 minutes. This has been used by about 20 other schools starting in 1998. And so we aren't the first school to do this. And I'm just commenting on the provisions of the building corporation and the time frames that are specified in the bill.
Well, this morning I brought this up as an issue. The state has a vested interest in the tax dollars that we put out there, whether it's in lease aid or whether it's in foundation aid formula or whatever it might be. And it seems strange that a bond holder would take the risk of holding a bond that you know, when you read subdivision 7 that says that someone cannot use that to purchase purchase land or buildings.
But they aren't using that to purchase land or buildings. That's what I'm saying.
Senator Saltzman,
I'd be glad to go through a 30-minute conversation of this, but it's a means of that nonprofits have used to procure facilities for a couple of decades. So it's used by nonprofits, it's used by healthcare, it's used by nursing homes, and it's something that's been used in Minnesota over the past decade for charter schools.
So on this point, Mr. Chair, this is sort of where we get into this gray area where, you know, this model has been used by nonprofits, but the concern that is raised is that when we have specifically noted, and there was not an intent for charter schools to own buildings, that this scenario has been set up. And I think that the point of this legislation, and I'd like to read something here that came from City Academy, which is a very successful charter school in St. Paul. It came from their director and from their administrator, and this came to me on February 19th, unsolicited. It was just talking about the work I was doing, and the concern there is that the focus on a charter school facility is often a red herring. It was never the intent of the legislature to create charter schools as another version of a traditional district. From inception, our school has been located in the city of the St. Paul in a city-owned building. Innovation in facility costs is not simply finding more ways to lease space from the private entity with public funds, but putting public funds to use in such a way that the public benefits and will survive past any single charter school. There are a significant number of publicly owned facilities at all levels, many of which would benefit from a lease arrangement with a charter school, a situation made all the more apparent by the current budget situation. If a charter school utilizes such lease fails, the public can rest a little easier, at least knowing that the facilities are still in public hands. They recommend looking at maintaining public funds in the way they were originally intended for public use. That's, you know, sort of another discussion here in terms of all this. So the intent of this legislation was that right now, that was what the legislator asked, you know, suggested in the 2003 report. It's very unclear should either come out and say charter schools can't do this or we should acknowledge that they're building corporations. And we go back to, you know, sort of the timeline that, you know, for charter schools before they reach their first benchmark to start investing in buildings seems a little premature, and that we want to make sure that their focus is on the academics, and then to wait till that 8 year. So looking at available space, when we consider again that our student demographics will stay pretty stable in the state, we see, and if students are moving between public and privates, between our public and our charter schools, should we be at least looking at available space in a community? And again, we involve the commissioner in that, and look at his or her judgment in the future.
Mr. Chairman,
if I may make a comment, I wholeheartedly agree with Senator Saltzman. In the situation of St. Croix Preparatory Academy, we have looked 6 years for facility space. We eventually were in four different locations, which meant we had four different infrastructure costs, office managers, and so on. We attempted to lease facilities from the traditional district. We attempted to even purchase facilities from the traditional district. So we were in a unique situation where there simply was not facility space available. So again, I think to get back to the verbiage in the bill, what this provides is an option if schools find themselves in a position where they have no other facility options. And this is the place where St. Croix Preparatory Academy found themselves. I agree wholeheartedly again with Senator Saltzman, because we often get phone calls from schools that have been in existence for a year or two saying, how do we set up a building company? And our response is, call us in a couple years, because you need to focus on academics, your enrollment, and your programming. What this allows, though, is the rare situation where schools that cannot find facilities at least have an option to do that and protect their programming in their school.
Well, I think we do have to move on. This is an area that we need to do some more work in. And I know it's going to have to go to judiciary, and then it's going to come back to the Finance Committee. and so we'll have some more opportunity. It does seem like the building corporation is set up to justify going around the existing law, and I'm not sure exactly what that's. If we comply with the existing law, then the building corporation is kind of in conflict with that. So, Senator Hahn.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I just would like to comment that, as has been mentioned, that most charter schools do not have building corporations. Some do. And I have been associated and worked closely with at least one charter school and a couple others in a less intimate way. But the challenge of finding appropriate space is a significant one. And it is not easy. And there are not all kinds of spaces available that meet the needs and the particular needs of a school. And so I think if we have a law that says we want to facilitate charter schools, we have to recognize that they need a place to have their classes. And most charter schools are not going to start out wanting to do this. I think the point is made that it's sort of a, if there's no other realistic option available, then you have to have some way to do this. And so I think we have to recognize that if this isn't the right mechanism, we have to find some other mechanism. I'm not so sure we ought to have a law saying they can't own a building in the first place, but we don't want to go down that path necessarily. But I do think that we should try to find ways to facilitate that. I do want to just offer, though, a brief amendment to the language that's in Section 17, and I think I can do it orally, but I am concerned about the putting in the specific years, and so I would want to, on page 17, line 23, just delete the word has at the end of the sentence and then go down to line 24 and delete operated for at least three consecutive years and replace all that with the word is. So it would read a charter school that is not currently in statutory operating debt and so forth. And then a similar amendment on page 18, the top 18.1, deleting the word has at the end of the sentence. And on 18.2, operative for at least eight consecutive years, and delete that and replace that with is, so it would say a charter school that is not currently in statutory operating debt and so on. That would be my amendment to just eliminate the designation of particular numbers of years to do these things.
Senator Hahn, you'll probably have an opportunity to do that in the Finance Committee when it comes back to. So, Senator Saltzman.
You know, just to speak that very briefly, I thought I was really sort of making this more liberal from what some of the other bills have, just flat 7 years. And so I am moving the timeline up for existing buildings, which is sort of like I'm starting to move in that, like in that direction, Senator Hahn, but now I try to find some compromise, and it's I want it all. So I feel that, you know, to have a charter school without any track record, going out, forming building companies, taking state money, they need to be able to have some benchmark. And I think that I've really tried to do that in this bill. And somewhere in here is the taxpayer. This is state money. People see some of these facilities being built and at first might think this is a private facility because they haven't passed a bond. In my community with St. Croix Prep, it's a beautiful facility, but you know, people thought it was a private school. We didn't pass a bond. It's for 1,000 students. And then they find out this is state money. How did this happen? Now, you can start to debate, is it state money or not, because it's bonds paying for it, it's going to be paid off. But essentially, that school would not be built if there wasn't lease aid being paid for by the taxpayers of this state. So this is just some taxpayer protection, I guess I would look at it.
Mr. Piccolo?
Senator, we believe that there should be some parameters around who can form a building company. It's just like not every person should buy a house and have a mortgage, and we've seen the result of that. There are some charter schools that should never be buying or creating building companies. And so we believe there should be some parameters. Currently, there are no parameters or any criteria for any of this. People have just gone on to do this as a way of trying to find buildings. And so we're supportive of putting in some processes here and some safeguards that people are have been doing some good work before they start focusing on buildings.
All right. We have, you offered your amendment, Senator Hammond, correct?
Well, and Mr. Chairman, if this is not the right venue to do that, then I'll withdraw it. But if it is,
No, we can vote on your amendment. The process of this bill will go, it has to go to judiciary, correct?
State and local government.
I'm sorry, state and local government. And then it'll come back to the Finance Committee and we'll get it back in the Education.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I'll hold off on the, I'll withdraw the amendment.
Okay. Senator Hand withdraws his amendment. Senator Saltzman, are there any other amendments, members?
He means it's going to come back to this committee. I do.
This is one area I want to spend some time on, though.
Yes, I just have an amendment, a very brief one, and this would be the A16 amendment, and it would be on page 16, after line 32. This was a sentence that was left out. It has to do with the sponsor fees. And it just mentions that the sponsor may assess a charter school a fee equal to the basic formula allowance during the pre-operational planning period. And this was left out. We will include that.
Okay. Just have that. On the A16 amendment, any discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Saltzman?
I believe I'm done, Mr. Chair.
I need a motion.
A motion. I would like to move Senate File 867 and as amended, and it be re-referred to the State and Local Government Committee.
Senator Saltzman moves that Senate File 867 as amended be recommended to be passed and re-referred to the State and Local Government Committee. Any other discussion? Senator Dahl?
Mr. Chair, and just thank you, Senator Saltzman, for all the work on this. I just want to ask Mr. Piccolo one question. This bill, as we've worked on it all morning and afternoon, is this a good bill?
Mr. Piccolo?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, I think it contains all the critical elements that we have been working for in terms of accountability and transparency of both sponsors and charter schools. Obviously, we are opposed to the limitation on 1 mile for 3 years, and we will continue to oppose that piece of it. But in terms of the rest of the elements, it is, I think, a solid starting point here. There are some things we believe need to be tweaked, a word or two here, but I think overall, I think it contains all the elements that we have been pushing for as an organization, and that do reflect the findings of the legislative auditor report, too.
Thank you.
Senator, is it okay? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say that to Senator Saltzman, the bill is significantly different than what came out of the subcommittee. And a lot of the changes, I think, are very positive. And I'm very glad. And what came out of the subcommittee was very frustrating to me because I and we've talked briefly about this, but not in depth enough. But it was very frustrating, and so I just wanted to say that in my as you know, I responded to some folks about this issue, and I vented, and I mentioned you by name. I used a broad brushstroke, and I shouldn't have done that because I was frustrated with the when this came out there. But I appreciate the changes you have made and the accommodations you have made. So I just wanted to say that. Doesn't mean I'm not going to be an aggressive defender of the charter school movement, and I think that it's a real positive thing for education. But I just wanted to say that from what came out of the subcommittee to where we are today is a significant improvement, and I appreciate that.
So if I just may respond, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, Senator Gerlach, and next time you're frustrated, you're always welcome to catch me on the floor and express your frustration before you send an email. but I would just say that in defense of the bill that came out of the subcommittee, as I was talking to one of our Senate leaders today, was sometimes you have to put something on the table to bring people to the table. And I was very clear when that bill was presented, there are many different options in here, and they don't necessarily all fit together. This may not be the bill, but it really brought people to the table to say, now let's start working on this issue and finding a compromise. And instead of getting emails back, we'll just delete that section, is, well, can we talk about this? And I think that's how we really create better legislation, is by, let's talk about this, but we can't work on it if people don't talk. So I really appreciate that, and I welcome people to continue to talk and meet with me or meet with others about, are there things to make this even a better bill? And, there, you know, the House has some different approaches, too, and we'll be negotiating with them at some point on this bill. So I welcome that.
On Senator Saltzman's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Senator Saltzman.
Next we have, is Senator Lynch here? If not, Senator Scogin, take your bill. This is Senate File 1636.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 1636 will be a library maintenance of effort a bill. And, Mr. Chair, I would like to move to get us started, the A2 amendment.
Senator Scogin moves the A2 amendment. We'll get this amendment handed out, and since it is a delete all amendment.
Maybe while it's being handed out, Mr. Chair, just my opening remarks. You know, this Senator session, Scogin, we have certainly heard a lot about maintenance of effort, mandates, flexibility, relief, stability in programs while trying to relieve some of that maintenance of effort. And the regional public library system was certainly put in a precarious situation. And Senate File 1636, as amended, will make library maintenance of effort still keeps it in place, but gives some flexibility to those who are required to provide that maintenance of effort. And I think you'll like the language that has been developed from some organizations that have worked very hard on this, including the Minnesota Library Association. Department of Ed has certainly weighed in, the League of Minnesota Cities, Association of Minnesota Counties, and Minnesota Intercounty Association as well. It makes some significant changes, the delete all, in that it does change the basis for calculating the minimum level of support, changes the requirement that the library budget cannot be reduced below a certain level, and it does allow cities and counties to reduce their library budgets by a proportionate amount that may be reduced through other cuts that we need to do to get us to the end number this year or in the next biennium. So Elaine Keefe is with us. I believe everybody has the amendment in front of them. If you want to vote on that, and then we can get some testimony from Ms. Keefe.
Senator Scogin moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Ms. Keefe, could you just lay out for the committee members where the issue came from? Because it actually was a result of the tax bill that was passed in 2008. And so if you could just give us a real brief outline of why this maintenance of effort is an issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Elaine Keefe, and I'm representing the Minnesota Library Association.
And actually, the genesis of this bill preceded what happened last year in the tax bill. In January of 2008, the regional public library directors decided to host a statewide meeting where they invited city and county officials to come in and meet with library directors to talk about library maintenance of effort. This has been a contentious issue for many, many years, and you know, we wanted to see if we could find some common ground and perhaps put the issue to rest. And we held that statewide meeting and subsequently appointed a committee of some county commissioners and some library directors who agreed to get together and work on this. And they worked through last spring and summer to develop some recommendations. In the meantime, what Senator Stump was referring to was there was a provision that was inserted at the very last minute in the omnibus tax bill last spring that suspended all maintenance of effort requirements for counties for the next 3 years. That was the duration that levy limits were to be in place. Caused some problems in a lot of different areas, not just for libraries, but in many human services areas. And so there was an agreement reached, you probably know, between the legislative leadership and the governor to repeal that provision as early as possible this session. And that repeal did take place, but with the understanding that many of these maintenance of effort requirements would be looked at very carefully this session. And so we feel like the work that we did last year really fed quite nicely into that commitment that was made to the cities and counties. The recommendations that were developed by the group of library directors and county commissioners who worked together last year formed the basis for this bill. But we did have to make some changes to accommodate some concerns by the Department of Education, which has to actually administer it, to make it workable, and also some concerns that the city and county organizations raised more recently. And so we had a lengthy meeting on Monday, and actually the language in front of you in the Delete All Amendment is the product of that negotiation that took place on Monday. And I think the end result is a very good one. It will allow public libraries to share the pain that our cities and counties will undergo because of cuts that everybody knows will happen and some already have happened due to the unallotment in their state aid, and without doing tremendous damage to library services. And so we think it strikes a good balance. And I should mention, too, that we have a history of being willing to make these compromises and step up when our cities and counties are experiencing this kind of pain. Back in 1992, we had a 2-year reduction of library maintenance of effort, and then more recently, for 3-year actually, and then more recently in 2003, we negotiated a 2-year reduction. These changes would be permanent, and so we're hoping that this will kind of put the issue to rest for some time. I'll go through the details of it. We're proposing 3 key changes. Under the current law, there is a minimum level of local support that cities and counties are required to provide. It's 0.82% of adjusted net tax capacity or a per capita amount that is adjusted every year. It's currently $12.62 per capita, and it's whichever is less between those two figures. One of the concerns raised by the county commissioners who worked with us is that tax capacity can be quite volatile. And in recent years, there are some counties that have seen double-digit increases in their tax capacity several years in a row, and that's been difficult for them to handle. And so what we're proposing to do about that instead is to change it so it's a 3-year average of the tax capacity. And that language is on page 1, beginning on line 8 and going through line, well, I guess it's just 8 and 9. So it would become a 3-year average of the tax capacity, and that would make it less volatile. We are delaying the effective date of this provision until 2011, and that's because right now tax capacity is declining, and so the counties kind of like that. And so while we all agreed it was good policy to do the averaging, I guess since we rode the bubble up, we'll write it down a little bit, and then we'll put this provision into effect. And then for those counties or cities that are above the minimum level of local support, there are some additional requirements under current law. They are permitted under current law to reduce their library budgets to the level of the second preceding year. So for 2009, they can go back to the level of 2007. And then in addition, under current law, if their tax capacity declines, they can cut their library budget by the same proportion. So if they get a 10% decline in their tax capacity, they can cut their library budget by 10%. And there were 13 counties and 45 cities that this year were able to reduce their library budgets because they had a decline in tax capacity. And we expect there will be many more next year. We are making two changes in this area for these cities and counties. We're allowing them to reduce their library budgets to the level of the second or third preceding year, whichever is less. So that gives them a little bit more flexibility. And that language is found on page 2 on line 5. The other advantage of this is that one of the complaints that we often hear from cities and counties is, once they put a dollar into a library, they have to put it in into perpetuity, at least every other year under the current law. And this would allow them to make one-time increases and then to take them back the next year. There are times when they say, you know, near the end of the year, we realize we have some extra money. We'd like to give it to the library, but we don't want to be on the hook for it forever. This solves that problem. And then the second thing we're doing is, and I think that's the real key thing here, is we're allowing cities and counties to reduce their library budgets by a proportionate amount when their state aid is cut. So for cities, that's LGA. For counties, it's their county program aid. And then I think for both of them, it's the market value credit. And this will apply whether the aid is unallotted by the governor or whether it is cut by the legislature. And this language, there's quite a bit of language because it gets a little bit complicated. We wanted to make sure that we covered the unallotment that took place at the end of 2008. The cuts that we anticipate will be made in 2009 by the legislature, which will occur after cities and counties have certified their levies for 2009, and then in addition into the future for the more normal kind of situation where the cut is known before the levy is certified. So there's a lot of language there, but paragraph B on page 2, which goes from lines 2.13 through 2.24, basically covers the 2009 situation, including the 2008 unallotment. And then paragraph C, which begins on page 2, line 25, and goes through page 3, line 6, covers the more normal ongoing situation, so that whenever there's an aid cut, they will be able to reduce their library budget in proportion up to 10%. And then the last provision I want to call to your attention is just a clarification, and that's paragraph D on page 3, lines 3.7 through 3.9, and that just makes it clear that regardless of the level of cuts that are permitted by this language due to aid cuts or going back to the third preceding year, they can't go below the minimum that's in the subdivision 1. That's an absolute rock-bottom minimum that we don't want anybody to go below. So we think this is a good bill that strikes a good balance between giving cities and counties some more flexibility but still protecting libraries from irreparable harm. And we'd urge you to support it.
Mr. Chair, I believe there are some others that would like to testify to the bill as well. And I believe Senator Bonhoeff might be working on an amendment that I want to make sure Elaine sees before, or Ms. Keefe sees before we take that up. So,
thank you, Ms. Keefe. We do have Ms. O'Rourke. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and we don't always come before the K-12 or Education Committee, so it's fun to be here today. In short, we want to just be on record in support of the flexibility that is in the bill that comes before you today, and just be on record asking you to strongly consider the mandate relief and the thoughtful approach that's in this bill. We did meet with you, Mr. Chair, and a few members of the committee on maintenance of effort funding earlier in the year, and I'm with the League of Cities. We're the statewide association. We've been working on various mandate relief efforts with both the MICA group, which is represented by Keith Carlson, and then the AMC, Association of Minnesota Counties, as well. Quite frankly, as you might guess, we're always looking for more flexibility, but this bill certainly does go a ways in that, especially as it's amended before you. I would finish my comments with one extra point, and that is with the conversations we've had with legislators in both the House and the Senate, there's been a lot of focus on mandates this year and maintenance of efforts in general. And I believe the Office of Legislative Auditor may have it on their list of items to be studying in the interim or for next year when they do their work. And I would encourage you to think about checking that one off if you have the opportunity, just because this is a big issue statewide and there's lots of opportunities just to look at this system and how it's funded overall. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. O'Rourke, for the reminder. We also had a reminder from Senator Rest, because she, I believe, is on that Legislative Audit Commission. So she said, told us to be sure to send our checklist in. Senator Bonhoff?
Mr. Chair, just briefly, I will have an amendment before you, but I suspect that Ms. O'Keefe will be in favor of this. The Hennepin County Library merger with that system happened in the last year, and so the bill that I had drafted that I'm now proposing be an amendment was with regard to the maintenance of effort on that, so that, you know, they did the merger to reduce costs and then didn't want to be held to have to spend the same amount after the merger as before. And so it merely said that it would be based on 85% of the combined spending of both Hennepin County and the City of Minneapolis Library for determining maintenance of effort purposes.
See, you know more than find a solution. And, our good friends to the west here will try to find a way around it.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Bonhoff's amendment addresses the initial, but would this not apply? Would the formula from here on would apply to that entity as well? I mean, I think she's just trying to get him past the merger initiate some cost savings there, and then this would kick in too.
Right.
Otherwise, correct me if I'm
wrong. Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I think so.
We don't have the amendment before us, and so my suggestion would be to Senator Scogin to just lay the bill on the table until that amendment comes, if we're done, and then Ms. O'Keefe or Keith can have a chance to look at the amendment, and Senator Scogin can look at it. Unless you know exactly what it is.
I know exactly what's in it, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
So I'm prepared to respond to it now, Mr. Chair, or if you'd prefer to wait so that members have it in front of them. But I've seen it, and I assume it's the same as your bill. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair. Also, the Hennepin County folks were part of this meeting that I described that took place earlier this week, and we had lengthy discussions about it. So I'm very familiar with this issue, and I'm happy to respond right now if you'd like.
Senator Olson, and who else is in the – well, I guess Senator Hand, Senator Rummel, all of you would be in that Hennepin County. You're in Hennepin County, I would imagine, a little bit.
Senator Michelle.
Senator Michelle.
Yes.
So are all of you comfortable with
– Well, with the Mr. Chair, let's wait until we have the amendment before them, because they can't see it.
But she can talk
about
it.
But I'm wondering if even before she addresses it, wouldn't you like to have the – you don't care? Okay.
All right.
She's there. Let's talk about it.
What's your pleasure, Mr. Chair?
Well, if the legislators here are comfortable with that language, then we can adopt it if that's.
Mr. Chair,
can we hear about it?
Based on the testimony of Ms. Keefe and relying on her knowledge of the piece of legislation that's in front of us, I would consider this an unfriendly amendment and would oppose it or ask members to oppose it.
Well, I don't have the amendment, so I'm just going by what it
is. So Mr. Chair, so either Ms. O'Keefe could talk right now about why, and then we could make a determination.
Okay. Ms. O'Keefe?
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment that I had seen previously, and I know the bill that Senator Bonhoff was, I don't know if it has been introduced, but was planning and introducing, would allow Hennepin County to reduce its library budget to 85% of the combined level that Minneapolis and Hennepin County had provided prior to the merger in 2007. So they would be able to go back 2 years and then cut an additional 15%. And that would be, I believe, for the next 3 or 4 years, through 2012. We think that it makes sense to allow Hennepin County to reap some of the savings from the merger, but we think that our bill, the language of this bill, allows that to occur. And, in fact, one of the things is that Hennepin County is very generous to its library, and they are right now providing a budget that is well above their maintenance of effort level. Their maintenance of effort for this year is $61.4 million. That is their combined 2007 amount. And their actual library budget is $74 million. So by my math, they could cut their library budget by 17% right now this year under current law without this bill and still meet maintenance of effort. So we think they have plenty of latitude. And with the passage of this bill, they'll be able to go back an additional year and make the cuts in proportion to the aid cuts that are coming, and actually that have taken place because of the unallotment, and that we anticipate will be even greater.
And doing some averaging.
Yes. Yeah. And so we think that this gives them plenty of latitude, and I have to say that the Hennepin County representatives who were, oh, and let me just say that under this language, with the 85% of the 2007 level, they'd be able to go down to about $52 million. So that's about a 30% cut from where they are right now. We think that's too deep. I don't think that the savings from the merger are going to be, you know, anywhere near that level. And the Hennepin County representatives who were part of this meeting, you know, seemed pretty satisfied when we explained it to them. And we did say that I think their big concern was they didn't want to have to have this year be their only opportunity to make a cut in order to reap the savings from the merger. They want to be able to make the reductions as the savings occur over a period of years. And we think that the language in this bill will permit them to do that. And I have to say that the lead lobbyist for Hennepin County even said to us, well, knowing our county board, they aren't going to cut a dime. They're probably, if anything, going to increase the library budget. So, but we did say that we would be willing in future years to revisit the issue if it didn't play out the way we anticipate that it will. But we think that this is going to give them more than enough flexibility to make the reductions to reap the savings from the merger.
So, Mr. Chairman.
So, Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, are you aware of whether, I know the first year or so of the sales tax for the Twin Stadium had an element in there beyond a certain level went to the libraries.
Right.
Is that, now has that slowed down a bit, or is there likely to be, is that likely to continue? And is that included in the $71 million that you're talking about, or the combined budget that they would be dealing with?
Ms. O'Keefe?
Mr. Chair and members and Senator Olson, I don't know if any of, if that sales tax has been in effect long enough that the library has received any of that money yet.
Oh, I thought they
but
had.
That money is exempt from maintenance of effort.
Okay.
And we did endorse that exemption because it is not a set amount of money. It's an amount of money that's unpredictable because it's whatever is left over after the bonds, you know, bond payments are made. And so that's going to fluctuate quite a bit. And so we thought it was reasonable to just exempt that from maintenance
Thank
of effort.
You.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd be willing to lay this on the table for now. And the Hennepin County folks didn't come to me and say, now don't go forward, but perhaps they didn't have a chance. And so I'd be willing to just lay it on the table, withdraw that motion, and talk to them.
Sure. When you say lay what on the table?
My amendment that I didn't quite move.
Okay. All right. We got it printed.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
It appears that what you're talking about is not as severe as what this is, and if Hennepin County is already favorable, acts favorably toward their libraries, why would we want to encourage them to go that much deeper? I mean, it gives them flexibility, but it doesn't create a situation where they can take full license if somebody else is whining more than in terms of not being cut.
Ms. O'Keefe?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I think I understood what you were saying. I think that the cuts that would be permitted under the bill that's before you would be smaller than the cuts permitted under the Hennepin County amendment or Senator Bonhoeff's amendment. And I think that the cuts that are permitted, even under current law, because Hennepin County is so far above their maintenance of effort level, you know, certainly ought to be sufficient. And then this bill allows them to go quite a bit further. So we think that that gives them plenty of latitude without any kind of special legislation.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoeff, I would suggest you not offer it, because if they were going to cut it, just might be the libraries in my district, and I wouldn't be very happy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, point taken.
Okay, Senator Scogin.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for hearing us today. And just to remind you that the regional library system certainly is willing to share the pain, looking for a little stability. This is where a percentage of our public is going now to seek employment, to get online, to fill out their unemployment requests, and certainly to look for educational opportunities. And we would like them to be held as harmless as possible.
Senator Scogin, there was a nice article or a nice news item on the TV news here about a week or so ago about the unemployment going to the libraries and using the computers. And so I think you're actually right on. I think our library usage is going up significantly. So, Senator Scogin, do you have a motion?
Where would you like this bill to go, Mr. Chair?
I think, Senator Scogin, to lay it on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus education.
I'd move Senate File 1636 be laid on the, as amended, be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, on Senator Scogin's motion, any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Senator Lynch. We have Senate File 1045.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Don't drink from that. We don't know whose it is.
It's been a long day. I'm happy to be here always. Senate File 1045, Mr. Chair. I have the A4 delete all amendment.
Okay. Senator Lynch moves. Well, no, Senator Dahl moves the A4 amendment, which will be handed out. And this is a delete all amendment. So, Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, members, what appears before you today is sort of phase two of what has been a long process. And many of you know that in the fall, along with Senator Sharon, Senator Lori, and Senator Rosen, under the jurisdiction of Senator Berglund's Health Finance Division, we put together a work group with a focus on mandate reduction and flexibility in the health and human services area. And along the way, there were a number of provisions that came to our work group, and some of those provisions, in fact, came to us and belonged in other jurisdictions, corrections, judiciary, and a few education pieces. We went through a number of the provisions, and not wanting to lose sight of some of the ideas that were brought forward by various stakeholder groups, I put together a couple of smaller mandate reduction flexibility bills. You saw some of that work in a bill that Senator Scogin had before your committee in recent weeks. The provisions in Senate File 1045 encompass some of those ideas. The provisions in Senate File 1045 also have financial implications to the state. And so they were grouped. For that reason, they appear in this bill. So that's kind of how we got here. And to the division I would just give you the same preface that I delivered in Health and Human Services and Corrections and Judiciary along the way. What appears in this bill at another period of time on another day might not appear in a bill before the legislature. That is, there are a number of things, number of provisions that are some difficult discussions. But in light of the budget challenges that we face, and you in this division know that as well as anyone, these are some initiatives, some ideas that I want to bring forward for your further consideration. And with that, Mr. Chair, I wonder if I could ask Mr. Nauman to assist us in walking through the provisions that appear in the bill.
Okay, thank you, Senator Lynch. Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm working off the A4 amendment to Senate File 1045. I presume it's been passed. Sections 1 and 2 go together and relate to a repealer. The non-public pupil transportation aid is repealed, and in conjunction with that decision, Section 1 provides school districts the ability to charge fees for actual costs of transporting non-public pupils. It also allows a school district to require a non-public student to be required to furnish his or her own transportation. Section 2 of the bill updates the public fee law to specify that public school students are prohibited from fees to be charged to, and that distinction is needed because of the change in the repealer. Sections 3, 4, and 5 go together and harken back to a decision that the legislature made in the 2003 legislative session when, as part of the budget balancing efforts in that year, we established a 25% fund balance limit for school readiness, ECFE, and community education. And the parts of, so Section 3 relates to ECFE, Section 4 is school readiness, Section 5 is community ed. Simply putting an adjustment to the 25 to the 20 for the purposes of ECFE and community ed would save dollars. Section 4 would require us to mechanically make an adjustment on the appropriation for school readiness. It's not a forecasted program, so we would need to make that adjustment to account for the size of the school readiness programs.
Mr. Chairman, can you just
excuse me,
to that
Mr.
point?
Nauman. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, when you say it would save dollars, does by not having to put it in the reserve account, are you saving the state dollars, or are you allowing greater flexibility for the local districts to use that 5%?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I think the way to think about this is that in 2003, the legislature said that you can't have a fund balance equal to greater than 25% of the amount of annual dollars that you receive. I shorthanded it as a fund balance, but really what happens mechanically is if a program, community ed, for example, has a reserve in excess of the 25%, and under this bill 20%, then the state aid payment in a future year is pulled down, and that's how it would save dollars, because we're going from a 25% limit to a 20% limit, so that the agency would go through and check to make sure that all the balances are, or the amount of dollars that they have are less, in fact less, and if they're not, then we would take an aid reduction.
So, Mr. Chairman, it does save
Senator
the state
Olson.
Money.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, if I wasn't clear on that, yes, it does save the state money.
Is that reflected? Is this amendment, excuse me, Mr. Chair and Mr. Nauman, is that reflected in the fiscal note or the spreadsheet here in terms of?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I sort of abrogated the rules and I took the preliminary fiscal note numbers. We don't have the detail. Most of what you are seeing on that number represents the savings as a result of the repeal of non-public pupil transportation aid, which is about $20 million a year. So there's a small number associated with this. But for those programs, I'm sure they'll tell you it's substantial.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, Section 6 is a similar provision to what was carried in the finance bill last year, where school districts were allowed on a one-time basis to make a fund transfer from their operating capital account to their unrestricted general fund equal to $51. Senator Lynch's provision doubles that and allows them to do it on a one-time basis for $102. And that provides flexibility. Section 7 is the class size reduction money, and in statute it's referred to as learning and development. And what this provision does is provide for the next biennium, allow school districts to use the dollars for the same purposes that all general education dollars are used for. So it loosens the restrictions and says that they don't have to use the dollars for class size reduction if they don't choose for the next biennium. And a similar notion is adopted in Section 8, where we temporarily suspend for 2010 and 2011 the safe school levies requirement. There's a whole series of requirements of how those dollars have to be used in law. And under Section 8, Senator Lynch's provision allows those dollars to be used for the same purposes as the general education aid program. That's what the reference 126C13 sub 5 is in both cases. Then the repealers, we've already talked about 123B92 subdivision 9. That's the repeal of the non-public pupil transportation aid. Subdivision 5 eliminates a reporting provision for the department to account for how school district transportation expenditures are made, and they use it for the purposes of some of the transportation programmatics. The 123A05 eliminates a reserve that funds the ALCs, the Alternative Learning Center programs. And these are dollars that school districts are required to set aside for the purposes of ALCs. So, Mr. Chairman, that is the content of the amendment.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, looking at the suspension of the dedication in Section 7, referred to as the class size reduction, presumably if there's the flexibility to use that, it may prevent some layoffs, which in fact could have the same effect. Is that not true, Mr. Nauman, or Senator Lynch?
Mr. Nolan?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lynch, maybe you choose to answer this. Pardon. I think that the school districts would probably speak to that point.
So they won't get the aid?
Senator Lynch?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, your question. Section 7.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lynch, Olson. That's the learning and development revenue temporary suspension that Senator Nauman made reference to is used to for class size reduction. Well, if it's allowed to use flexibly and saves a teacher's job or two, it technically has that effect anyway.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Lynch.
Senator Olson, that would be one way of looking at this. I think the flexibility that comes in for the school districts is, as I understand it, those dollars are for particular grade levels, and this is giving districts flexibility so that during the next biennium, if they have needs, particularly in another grade level, that those funds could be expended there or for other general education purposes. So, again, just trying to afford some additional flexibility to districts.
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, on another point, are we going to hear some testimony from people on this bill and some of these provisions?
Yes, we will hear from whoever wants to testify. We have okay. some.
I'll wait until after some testimony.
Senator Colk.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, my question is to the repealer on the non-public student transportation. So currently, as I understand it, under 123B.92, we provide aid to the school districts to transport non-public schools students. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman.
And what is that? And if so, what is that dollar amount?
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Koch, Currently, the forecast is for about $21.2 million, I believe, for fiscal year 10. Hypothetically, if you were to add dollars to the formula allowance, there is a formula that keys to the formula, so it goes up by the ratio of the increase. Conversely, if the legislature were to choose to reduce it, it would go down by that amount. So that's a shorthand way of thinking about how the formula works. It's about $21 million this next year.
And so then,
Senator Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Lynch, under Subdivision 3, there's just going to be no requirement for those students to be transported to school.
Senator Lynch.
We're going to remove the state aid, and then no requirement, plus perhaps be charged a fee. Private school students may be charged a fee.
Mr. Chair and Senator,
Senator Lynch.
Senator Koch, the intention is to offer some flexibility. So if a district may choose to continue to enter or have that arrangement where your private students, charter students, are being bused as they are in Rochester today and I suspect in other districts, that option would still exist. But what would be different is the state aid that assists with that today would not be there. And further, districts would then have the opportunity to engage in negotiations or discussions with those parents or with those schools, those private schools, as a means of creating a funding mechanism for that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynch, I understand that, but Senator taking away the aid, even though it's an option for them, you're going to make it, I'm guessing a lot of school districts will opt not, would be my guess now. I mean, they're doing it now, and they're receiving some form of aid. I would also just point out that, you know, students that attend non-public schools, and as my daughter attended a Catholic school for many years, we still pay property taxes, we're still paying income taxes, and so this is a small level of service that can be provided to transport our students back and forth. And so I know we're making some tough calls this year, but I have great concerns about this one.
Mr. Chair, that's what I was hoping we'd have some testimony.
It might be interesting, and I'm not sure. My tenure doesn't go back far enough, but there was a time when I think before we actually had the transportation funding formula, that all parents had to pay, or at least school districts could assess parents to pay for transportation costs. And then I think we got into the formula of funding transportation. And
Mr. Chair, that's different than signaling out. Certainly.
Yeah. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, it was Representative Barb Sikora's father, John Swack, when he was here, that I think initiated the transportation of students, the whole transportation issue to public schools. And I'm not sure if private were included at that time or not. But I'm hearing different things flying around here that this doesn't eliminate the aid,
but it must eliminate
the aid if we're going to have savings to the state of that $20 million. So it takes away the aid. So
yes.
Why would a school choose to do that? Or would they get aid if they chose to do it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, it might be helpful to look at the base bill for the purposes so you can see the repealer. So I'm on second to the last page of the bill. It's 5R, and that's 123B92, Transportation Aid Entitlement. And you see the district reporting provision that I mentioned earlier, that's sub 5. Sub 9 is the non-public pupil transportation aid, and this is the formula, how it's calculated, and there's the 126C sub 2 linkage is to the that's the reference to the formula allowance. So this is what's actually being repealed, and that would repeal the non-public pupil transportation aid if that were to prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Nauman, for pointing that out. Since we're working off the amendment, it's hard to see that. So, thank you. Senator Lynch.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, what this would do is it would be a local decision.
made by that local school board as to whether or not they were going to entertain that kind of an arrangement. And again, I stress to members, I mean, this is, it's equally difficult to bring some of these items forward. And I do so with full recognition of the magnitude of what we're talking about here, for sure, most definitely. But I also believe that we are facing some extraordinary challenges, and we cannot afford to do business as we have been doing. And so I come to you today to try to bring forward some items for your consideration as we try to move forward.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Koch.
I would suggest, Senator Lynch, that yes, you're allowing for a local option, but you're making a state decision to take away the state aid, forcing the local decision. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, when you're attending a non-public school, and I know we can get into all sort of discussions, but again, these people are income, they pay their income taxes, they pay their property tax, and they pay additional fees and tuition for their child to attend a private school for a variety of reasons. And in return, there are certain minimum services that we provide as a state, and that's nurses, that's some food, and then I think it should be some transportation. So, this is the issue that I have with this. So to cut out the transportation for thousands of students in the state of Minnesota, I'm just not okay with this, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hamm.
Well, and I guess I was kind of asking the same questions in my mind. I'm curious to know if this was part of the mandate list that the School Board Association, maybe they'll come and talk about it. I think if I understand the mandate is to do transportation, it might be, maybe we ought to just say there should be no mandate to provide transportation to any student and let school districts provide that by fee to anyone who wants it. That would be the fair way to do this, to say no transportation to any student, anybody that wants to get a bus, they have to pay a fee. I don't know how well that would fly, but that would be at least an even-handed way to do this. I do think it's a little bit problematic to single out one group. So,
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, you make some valid discussion points, and I have been involved in some of those conversations leading up to this along the way. Mr. Chair, this might be a good and appropriate time to ask MSBA to come
sure.
forward.
We also have some others that would like to testify too. So welcome, Ms. Kelleher and Mr. Kite.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. And to answer Senator Hunt's question first.
Ms. Kelleher, could you move the microphone just a little bit closer so we can pick it up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this better?
Yes.
To answer Senator Hunt's question about whether we tried to single out non-public schools, the answer is really no. Our problem with the transportation formula is it's underfunded, and our general fund usually flows out to fill in the gaps. So we also considered at one point just not providing transportation. Times are truly desperate for school districts, and we're going to be forced to make a lot of tough decisions. Part of what this request asks for is significant flexibility in the law to address those that fit the community's needs. And we purposefully, if you can remember, there was a list of about 100 we started with. We really wanted to think outside the box on things that might give local boards tools to keep teachers. By April 1st, unrequested leave applications have to go out to our staffs on who we're not going to provide a job for next year. That's a significant discussion boards need to have. And the more flexibility we can give the members, the more teachers we can save. And I want to thank Senator Lynch for her support. She really showed some leadership here. These are a lot of the issues people really don't want to talk about. I mean, they're not the discussions we like to talk and get to at the state. But in fact, if we are talking about the kind of cuts Senator Pogomiller and Senator Stumpf, you've shared with us, we truly need not only mandate relief, but extreme flexibility to do the best we can for the students of our districts. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Mr. Kite.
Senator Stumpf and members of the committee, I'm Charlie Kite with the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And I'll try to frame this just a little bit differently and maybe even offer a way out of the morass here. First of all, Eric Nauman mentioned that it's costing the state somewhere in the neighborhood of $21 million, I think, per year. That translates out more or less on a complicated formula to about $230 per student transported. Generally, across the state, no matter if you're transporting public children, private school children, the $230 does not cover the full amount in many areas. Part of the reason for that is school buses are getting much more expensive, a lot of regulations that we're making them very safe, fuel costs are going up, and so forth. So what's happening across the state is that school districts are subsidizing the transportation system by taking basic aid dollars, which you originally really intended for the education of the children, to pay for the transportation system. That's all in good. You've got two issues here that you're really wrestling with. The first one is does the state look at some ways to save $21 million or not? That's one issue, and that's a decision you all have to make. The second decision is, at the local district level, how much of the basic foundation aid that you receive for the education of the public school students should you use to transport, number one, your own children, and number two, the private school children? And there, if you think about it at the local district level, there is a solution, and the solution is this, is that if you look at the amount of aid, I'll use the number $230, to the degree that it costs more than that, that you would then ask the private school or also a charter school, if they're in the same situation, to make up the difference, just as the public school is making up the difference for their own students. That's a way to kind of start to solve the problem, kind of a half step at the local level. It does not answer your question about do you want to spend the X number of million dollars or not. So I just offer that. We've actually had this discussion over in the other body, and we've actually made a proposal that this kind of a compromise might be made. It would help to take some pressure off the local school districts, load a little bit of that cost onto the private schools, but not be to the extent where it would make this a horrible situation for them.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
But Mr. Chairman, each one of those non-public schools is saving the state the general formula. They're not, that we're if they were to come in, that we'd be required to fund them that way, and we don't even have the money to do that. So they're saving us money. They're easing the problem. Maybe the least that we could do is to waive their having to pay the referendum on their property tax, since they aren't getting that service. They're funding entities that they're not using, and maybe they should have a little relief because they are in fact helping relieve the state of a burden, and you haven't counted that at all.
Mr. Wright,
Senator Stumpf and Senator Olson, that's one way of presenting the argument. On the other hand, citizens of the state, first of all, have a general obligation to support a system of public schools. Secondly, parents do have an opportunity for some choice of where they want to go. So I think that argument can kind of be made a couple of different ways. I acknowledge what you're saying, but at the same time, the public schools, when they have an allocation of money to transport students, and to the degree it costs more than that amount, they are doing some subsidizing at that level.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson?
You note, I didn't say that they should get credit on their sales tax and income tax, just the property tax referendum part.
Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kite, do we have a sense of that 200, let's say it on average is $230 per student. Does that vary from district to district?
Mr. Kite?
Senator Stumpf and Senator Rummel, it does have some variation. There's some range in the formula. I asked Tom Melcher to explain it to me the other day, and he did, and I, be honest with you, I didn't quite understand it, but it was, it is close into that range, and there's some variables, but it's I think that number for the purpose of this discussion is relatively accurate.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Rummel.
So, Mr. Kite, for those of us who have no idea what the difference is between what you need for transportation and what you're getting, how much additional dollars would that put on to the folks who who send their children to private schools?
Senator Stump and Senator Rummel, again, it would be different. First of all, it depends on where these schools are located. You know, you'll have a community that maybe has three or four schools in it, public schools, and has maybe two parochial schools, and they're all located sort of in the center of town. There's very little differential of how much it costs to transport. On the other hand, if you have a private school or a charter school located way out in the far corner of your district, which some schools do, and they're collecting students from the entire school district to get to that school, the cost there is a cost differential. So it's hard to predict school district to school district. I also say this, is that if you look at school districts across the state, they go from an example, I believe the Richfield School District, if I'm more or less correct, I think is made up of 6 square miles. It's 3 miles by 2 miles. The Grand Rapids School District, which has the same number of students in it, has 3,000 square miles. Now, I acknowledge that the Grand Rapids School District does get transportation sparsity aid to help, but there's huge differences in what it costs to transport students different places in the state.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Koch.
Well, Mr. Chair, why don't you start? Go ahead, Senator Olson.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, how much more is it costing the school district than what they will lose in aid? $20 million is going to be a reduction, so it isn't as if you're continuing to get it and not having to transport them. You're not going to get it. Does that help you?
Senator Stump and
Mr. King.
Senator Stump and Senator Olson, I believe in districts where they contract for transportation, they contract by so many dollars per student. So if you have fewer students being transported, you have lower costs. If a school district actually owns their own bus and their own fleet, unless they could make some savings by reducing a route or reducing one bus or driver, they'd have a harder time recouping that. I think you're making a good point.
So, Mr. Chairman, you are.
Senator Olson.
This is less money that you're going to be getting.
Senator Koch.
So, Mr. Chair, I would like to make a motion for an amendment if I could at this time, or would you like to wait with them?
No.
Unless you
want to hear maybe on, there's a couple more that have indicated they'd like to testify
Okay.
Before we deal with amendments.
Then. That's fine.
Okay. Mr. Feel?
Yes.
And Mr. Brown?
Mr. Chair, my name is James B. Field. I'm the president of the Minnesota Independent School Forum, and which is in a consortium of private high schools. And because there isn't a representative other than myself that represents all the private schools, I speak on behalf of every fourth school in Minnesota, one-fourth of the schools, 530 schools, educating. They're called non-public schools by law. They educate just about 85,000 students, and like was discussed here, save the state about $1 billion a year, just under that. I'd like to tell you a couple facts about this. One of the problems that we have in private schools is we're losing students. 6 years ago, about 10% of the school population went to private schools. Now it's hovering around 9.5%. For every child that can't afford to go to the private school anymore, he ends up in a public school. And the way the formula works, it does help the public school district. But in terms of the state, it costs each of those children costs the state about $10,000. I was just at St. Bernard's this morning talking to them, and you may have read in the paper that they've closed their grade school. They have 150 to 160 kids in their grade school. So I asked Jennifer Cassidy to give me an estimate of those 150 kids, what would happen. And she said we think about 50 of those would transfer to the public schools. That in itself costs the state $500,000. If this amendment went through, I'm sorry, if this section 6 went through, we will lose some private school students. In the rural areas, this is going to be very devastating. And the ethical problem that I have is that it's going to hurt the low-income students the most. And I think everybody in this room knows that we are the worst state in the country in terms of the achievement gap. Private school students, because the schools are smaller, very supported with parents and volunteers, they're able to, private schools don't have a gap. And they have a 99% graduation rate. This shouldn't be a law that hurts those schools. Truly, those schools are an asset to the state and a savings of money. And it should for sure not hurt our low-income families who make great sacrifices to keep their children in a non-public school. That's all I have to say. I'd be glad for questions.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Field. Mr. Brown?
Mr. Chairman, Morgan Brown with the Education Department. Although Tom Melcher is not here in person, he is here virtually thanks to the miracles of technology, and I asked him to send a brief email explaining non-public transportation aid. He says it's based on the district's average transportation cost per pupil transported for all students, public and non-public, in the second prior year adjusted for inflation. So it depends on whether the per pupil cost for transporting non-public students exceeds the average for all students in terms of whether there's a differential. So that obviously does, that average does vary from the 230 number we're using around the state, depending on what that average is for various districts. The department wants to testify in opposition to this provision, the bill, for a couple of reasons. And one thing I do want to clarify related to some of the earlier testimony is that this bill does repeal the section that provides non-public pupil aid currently, right? That's gone. So there would not be non-public pupil aid provided. So I think that's important in understanding the impact of the amendment when it says the district has the option of either saying the parents of the child must transport the child themselves, or that the districts may charge the private school for the actual cost of transporting the students. They wouldn't just be charging the private school the differential between what's provided in non-public pupil aid and what the actual cost is. There is no more non-public pupil aid, so they would be charging the private school for the entire cost of transporting that student. And obviously, not only does that go against a long tradition that we've had in terms of providing transportation for all students within a district, but it does create, and Mr. Fields, he mentioned this, but the real concern is if the options are either that parents provide it on their own or a private school gets charged for the cost, it will have a disproportionate impact on low-income students attending private schools. And contrary to probably the stereotype that may be out there, we do have certain private schools that serve very high numbers of low-income students. And so the result will be for those parents, if they're required to provide on their own, they won't be able to, and that child will not be able to continue attending that private school. Or if they have to charge it all to the private school, and remember these are private schools serving large amounts of low-income children on scholarship, they're going to have to take away from what they're providing on scholarship for these kids to attend the private schools to cover the transportation costs, which means they'll probably only be able to provide reduced numbers of scholarships, reduced number of kids attending the school. Either way, it has a disproportionate impact on those kids, and as a result, is going to impact the cost estimate for this bill because those kids will need to come back into the public education system and generate state dollars for that public education. So I think those are all things that we really want the committee to think about before approving this provision.
Mr. Brown, I want to just clarify something. You mentioned that, were you testifying in opposition to all of the provisions in the bill or just
no.
to that one?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that clarification. Just to what in the Delete Everything Amendment is Section 1, Subdivision 3A.
Okay. Senator Rummel and then Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, I appreciate the courage that it took to bring this bill forward or this suggestion forward, but in my school district, we just passed a levy, and we passed it with about 64% support. The way we got that support is to bring in all of our private parochial and schools and discuss with them the relationship of our traditional district with them. So if this were to pass, and I have not had an opportunity to talk to anybody, it sounds like either our school district would have a breach of faith. Now, we live in a district, Senator Stumpf, that fewer than 1 in 5 households has a child in any school. And so to get a 64% support for that levy took a huge amount of work, and it took a lot of cooperation from our private schools. So I think we would be coming up with a breach of confidence type thing. We would have to either take money out of the money we earned from the levy to pay for the transportation that we discussed when we were selling the levy. So it puts us in a very awkward position, and so I will probably oppose this section.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do appreciate the bringing this forward, and I think it's perfectly appropriate. Some of us may not like it, but I think we should talk about these things. We should talk about more of them. We've got lots of opportunities to relieve mandates, find ways to give greater flexibility to schools. The biggest one has to do with managing the staff, and we haven't talked about that at all, and I wish we would, and I've had some bills I've introduced that haven't been heard that would do that. So I appreciate the bringing it forward. I did want to get some clarification about how this would affect or would it affect charter schools. We had testimony, I think Mr. Kite mentioned charter schools and with private schools, but they're not the same. And so maybe Mr. Nauman, I don't know if you this did not affect any transportation of charter school students, or does it? I guess I'm trying to understand that.
Senator Hand, it does not apply to charter schools. So, Senator Koch.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair. Then Bell. I'd like to offer my amendment. It's a verbal, because I'm sorry, wasn't ready for this.
Before you do that, we're going to have to adopt this amendment. We didn't take a vote on this amendment.
We did.
Senator Dahl, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify to Senator Rummel. Wouldn't it be the school board that still would have the option of making that decision? It would still be optional for the school district, correct?
Yes, I assume it would be. But what the school board promised to the community about what they would do with the money was not transportation. And so they would have to use money that they had put in their promise to the community for other things to provide transportation. Otherwise, there would be a breach of confidence with the public. And you know how hard it is to win that confidence and win that support. I think it would be lost for years and years and years. I don't know if we'd ever be able to pass a levy again.
Okay. Senator.
Mr. Chair, you want to move the A4?
Yes. Senator Kolk, do you want to move that?
All right, I'll move the A4 amendment to start.
Senator Kolk moves the A4 amendment so that we have it before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Kolk.
Mr. Chair, I have another amendment. It's verbal. On page 1 of the A4 amendment, we would delete sections 1 and 2. Then on page 4, line 31, we'd have to delete and 9 is what council's told me. And Mr. Chair, and I can't tell you how I appreciate Senator Rummel's comments, because what I was starting to hear was sort of an argument of our kids and their kids, and we're really talking about Minnesota kids here. That's Minnesota kids getting to school. We're going to have a lot of tough decisions, and Senator Lynch, I do appreciate what you're doing, and I've been on board with the mandate reduction really up to this point. I've been one of the gung-hoers on it. But this one, I just think, sends the wrong message. And so I hope I'll have members' support for this. It would just delete this. We're going to have lots of conversations about the $21 million in reductions. Mr. Chair, I'm not necessarily supporting your reductions to education, but that's the conversations we're going to have in the future. I just appreciate support on this.
Senator Salzman.
And I apologize if I've missed, Mr. Chair, prior to this conversation, but I think that this debate over the cross subsidy is the issue. It's not about so much their kids, our kids. I mean, charter schools, it's, frankly, it's the same situation of where a school district gets so much money but the real cost could be hundreds of dollars more. And who is paying the cost? It's the students that are in the district school. And that's where, in a way, they are paying. And especially when you look at public, at non-public and charter schools, that a school district can't build in efficiencies because the enrollment area, maybe you've already had this discussion, the enrollment area is the entire district. There is no boundary, whereas the school district creates boundaries. I know that when I was looking at the Chicago charter school policy, one of the things that they do with transportation is that they provide transportation up to within 6 miles of the student, you know, that they're sort of a, we'll pay for transportation within 6 miles when you have this open enrollment. So it just, I'm not sure where, if that helps this conversation. It's just trying to address the burden on students.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Cole.
I have to just respond a little bit. And Senator Saltzman, you weren't here for some of the discussion. We talked about the cross-subsidy, and I understand that is an issue. I didn't hear any actual numbers for the cross-subsidy. In fact, there was a suggestion that you really can't stuff to what kind of cost savings might there be is really hard to enumerate, because if you're not cutting out buses, you're not necessarily cutting out any kind of – the cross-subsidy is sort of a nebulous term. And so we can continue to have that conversation. But also I would point out that, you know, we're talking about student dollars, but ultimately we're talking about public dollars, public funding, which that's people, whether their kids go to public school or non-public school, and I've had a daughter in public in non-public school, and now she's in public school. These are public dollars, not necessarily just school dollars. So.
Before we take the vote, I just want to thank Senator Lynch for bringing this forward. Mr. Field brought up a point about when a private school closes and a portion of those students go back into the public system. It would be interesting if we could figure out exactly what that cost savings may or may not be, and that's difficult to determine. But and this is a tough issue, very tough. Next few weeks, very shortly, we'll have to figure out how we're going to balance our budget, and that's going to be very tough too in terms of reductions, and so it's I appreciate your effort in doing this. So any other discussion?
No.
If not, all those in favor say the Senator Koch's amendment to sections 1, 2, and I believe, and part of 9. On that amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? No.
No.
Amendment no. Does not prevail.
Yes,
I mean, the amendment prevails. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I thought I was doing
I'm
well.
Sorry. The day is getting long.
Division. Mr. Chair.
I've
seen a lot of. I think I'd like to be a member of this division. I think I could work with you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you. Senator Lynch, thank you so much for bringing this forward. And some of the things I just want to point to that I really like in this bill. Start with that. I like the capital account fund transfer. I think that's wonderful. I like the safe schools levy, the temporary suspension. I think that's great. I think basically we could even go farther in terms of some of those abilities to transfer between funds, and I'm hopeful that by the end we might. But one of the repealers I'm concerned about is 123A.05, and that is the Area Learning Center Organization. And what that is school districts who participate in those have provisions set up for students who are really their at-risk students who aren't doing well. I know in Hopkins we have the program called the HAP, Hopkins Alternative Program, and they have been extremely successful with graduation rates. They just do a phenomenal job of taking these kids who aren't surviving and thriving in the regular program and working with them in a very different and innovative way. And so I would hate to repeal this and have an unintended consequence that we got rid of that.
Senator Lynch?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoeff, I too am a large supporter of area learning centers. In fact, in my largest school district in Rochester, we have such a program. But perhaps Mr. Nauman can help clarify, and if you look at the original bill, again, the language on this repealer is on, it says 2R of the repealer, because this is, this has to do with reserve account revenue. Mr. Nauman, maybe you can provide some further comment on that.
Mr. Nauman?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. What you don't see in the on page 2R is the entire area learning center statute. And the way this works is if a school district is provided the authority to establish an ALC if it wants, and if it does, then it has to reserve the revenue that you see described here. So essentially what we'd be saying, if the repealer were to prevail, a school district could establish an ALC, but there would be no funding mechanism for it.
So,
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, in the capital account fund transfer, I suppose you have some runs as to how much how much revenue districts get from that source of funding, and will this $102, one, it would allow them to continue the 51 for that they had last year or this current year, and be able to are they able to do that for each year, or is that allow that to continue for 2 years by taking the 102? I don't know if that's the case, but if that is that equally accessible for all districts across the state?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, the language provides it equally accessible to all districts. However, last year we provided this authority for school districts to make a one-time transfer equal to $51 per pupil. Some did, some didn't, and they made individual choices about that. Those that did were predominantly those that had the available resources. So by making that last transfer, they may or may not have it
for this year.
Of course, they get operating capital every year, and that was the first time we've done anything like that in sort of a blanket way. I think what we'll find is that some districts will have the revenue, and this will be beneficial to them, and it's up to $102 per kid, so they could do a lower amount if they so chose. So I think it'll be spotty. And we can certainly produce a data run. I haven't done so yet, but given the committee's interest in this, I'm sure that you'll ask me to. So we'll do that soon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that wouldn't really have any relationship to the provision I'm talking about that Senator Lynch repealed. And I think she might have inadvertently repealed the whole section rather than just the ability to do it or not do it. Because if you repeal the whole section, there isn't a mechanism in law to fund an area learning center, even if you wanted to, because we would have just repealed the formula for doing so.
Mr. Chairman, she just repealed Subdivision 2, and that is the revenue
Senator
part.
Senate Counselor Ms. McQuaid, can you explain what in Section 9 do we actually need? It seems like if we repeal the provision that you have relating to the area learning centers, we basically will shut down the area learning centers, and I'm not sure that that's in your intent.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Nauman surely can help with this, but as I recall in our discussion, the intent wasn't to shut down area learning centers. The intent was to give some flexibility with regard to the funding mechanism associated with that. And if we've not done that, I would suggest that was the intent. And if it's the will of the committee, you know, that might be something you want to look further at.
Senator Lynch, maybe Ms. McQuaid, what is actually in? We had another mandate bill that was passed. Senator Scogin was chief author, and that had some repealers in it as well. Ms. McQuaid?
Mr. Chair and committee members, what was repealed in addition to other sections in Senate File 672 in Senator Scogin's bill was 123B92 Subdivision 5. That bill did not repeal 123A05 Subdivision 2, and the currently the committee has stricken Subdivision 9, so that's no longer repealed.
So the question is do we need the repealer language at all, unless we can figure out a way to...
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Nowlin.
It certainly is a policy choice to, in a sense, eliminate the ALCs. And if you were to do that, it might be cleaner to eliminate everything. But if you were inclined not to go that direction, then I think given what Dr. McQuaid has just spoken to, you could get rid of the entire repeal.
Mm-hmm. The Section 9?
Section 9, mm-hmm. I think, would be the... the amendment to eliminate Section 9 would take care of the Area Learning Center issue.
Do you want a motion to that effect?
if this committee wants to maintain Area Learning Centers, we probably should repeal it.
Yeah. I'd so move.
Senator Olson moves the deletion of Section 9. And as Ms. McQuaid just mentioned, the other provisions are either in the bill that Senator Scogin has or have been already eliminated. So on Senator Olson's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Okay, is there any other discussion? Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This will, again, reflect my lack of understanding on school finance. How does the Safe School Levy temporary suspension save money? I just don't understand how that's going to work.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rummel, I guess I would not think about that as saving money. What it would do is provide additional flexibility in the use of the dollars. You were interested in the Safe Schools. So the additional flexibility in the way the dollars are used. Under 126C44 right now, there is a collection of uses, and occasionally this committee receives bills that expand the use or make alterations to the use, similar to allowing other revenue streams to be used for flexible purposes. That's what this does.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rummel.
So the district still has the levy money, but they can use it in a variety of ways.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rummel, yes, it relieves the hooks on the money.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, refresh my memory. In Senator Scogin's bill, did we eliminate the maintenance of effort for one segment that was within the Safe Schools area?
Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chairman, I don't recall that it did. I think we endeavored to keep money issues out of that bill.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson,
Ms. McQuaid.
Senator Scogin's bill, Senate File 672, that does strike the maintenance of effort for Clause 6 of the Safe Schools, which is for nurses.
Because
yeah,
if that stayed in place, that wouldn't Senator Olson. Give the flexibility, mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Lynch.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Rummel, if I may, also on Section 8 with regard to Safe Schools, with recognition that these are tough conversations to have, one of the provisions that is contained within that Safe Schools, you'll note, is that this is effective for the next biennium only. And that was, frankly, in the spirit of compromise, if you will. Because, again, you know, I'm not here to suggest that these are necessarily the greatest policy initiatives that have ever crossed the desk of this committee.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know there's a great deal of pain in recommending these suggestions, but I would still respectfully move to delete Section 8.
Senator
the
Wieger.
Safe school levy.
Senator Wieger moves to delete Section 8.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Wieger.
The reason is the positions that school counselors, social workers, psychologists, and others, they are usually often cut in the budget cycle. We've just spent, I think, two hearings talking about problems with safe schools when we talked about bullying prevention. I think we rate 49th in counselors. The flexibility here might put us to 50th. I feel that these positions provide a safety net, and the small amount of money is not worth putting further reductions for those affected. So that's why I'm suggesting it, though I'm totally aware of why flexibility would be appreciated. But the populations these people serve are vulnerable, and these staff positions are already grossly underfunded.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Senator Wieger, I'm going to suggest that that's not a favorable amendment.
Right.
And I just want to and I know that you as members of this division have been involved in the very same conversations and discussions. But I have to just remind all of us that in virtually every conversation that I have had in recent months with education stakeholders, particularly with Education Minnesota and MSBA, and in every one of those conversations, I have, I like to think that I have been upfront in acknowledging that we are not in a position to be able to afford them additional appropriations, but rather if we can focus on the things that are within our jurisdiction to provide them some assistance. And while I wish, like many of you, that we could afford them additional appropriations, we can give them flexibility. And I just ask members to afford them, if only temporary, some flexibility, because our schools and our people in the front lines are struggling.
Senator Bonhoeff.
Mr. Chair, I just want to echo Senator Lynch's comments that that was one of the things that jumped out at me, is that this is a real solid flexibility we're delivering. It's not smoke and mirrors, and so I appreciate that, and so I, too, do not support the amendment.
Okay. On Senator Wieger's, I'm sorry, we have some, please give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Ralph Maves, and I'm representing the Minnesota School Psychologists Association today, although I think my remarks also reflect how the thinking of the other groups within Student Support Services. I just want all senators here present to realize the history of the work that we've done trying to get some extra funding for Student Support Services. I've been at the legislature now for 10 years, and people were working on this issue when I came, and I and others have been working on it ever since. And last year was the first time that we were able to get some extra monies for Student Support Services. So you need to recognize that this money here that's been set aside for Student Support Services is this year has been the first year that that's been in place. I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mays. On Senator Wieger's motion, which is to delete Section 8, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion does not prevail. So, Senator Bonhoeff, or Senator Wieger, you want to move this bill? Or
yes.
Okay. Senator Wieger moves Senate File 1045 as amended. To lay on the table for possible inclusion into the omnibus education finance bill.
No, it's just
Any other discussion? Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair and members, once again, I just want to say thank you for the work that you did today. And these were difficult conversations, but I think they were conversations that were necessary to have. And I wish you all the best in your forthcoming work. And if at any time you, my only regret in serving in the Senate is that I don't have a spot at this table. So if I can ever help, please don't hesitate to call on me.
We wish you did too. So.
Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Lynch. And on Senator Wieger's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. And that, I think, concludes our work. Thank you, committee members, for coming back this afternoon.
I have transportation in this room until 10 tonight.
I guess that's
yeah.
The committee is adjourned.
Bye. Bye.